silence in their bedroom. I had to walk out the room, overcome with emotion. Suddenly, I am holding my husband's hand at our own wedding, watching our nephews play football outside a giant teepee while our friends mingle in the sun. I ask Bob what his most vivid memory is. His answer surprises me. It isn't a wedding, or a birth, or a traumatic experience. It's just a nice, normal day. It's the 7th of May, 1970, to be precise. This day really sticks out, says Bob. I remember it very clearly. I was 20, I was in college full-time, and I was also working in a mental health centre as an orderly. On March the 13th that year, I had done some impressions in class, and people loved it, so I was being taken up to the main campus to do a speech course. It was a beautiful spring weather day. I went to 6 o'clock mass because I had to work 7 till 3, and I remember walking to church up these steps and being very aware of how happy I was. Then I worked and went to a bowling class. I went home and drove my car up to the branch campus, and we met the professor and two other students. I'd never been up to the main campus, and it was hustle and bustle and beautiful, and I was very aware of that. I remember the whole day and all my feelings, as well as the cool breeze against my face. It was just a really nice day. It made me wonder why the rest of us don't remember more of this mundane stuff. Is there any benefit to forgetting? The American psychologist William James said in the late 19th century that if we remembered everything, we should, on most occasions, be as badly off as if we remembered nothing. Most of our autobiographical memories, he said, go through a process of foreshortening. We omit facts and emotions associated with our past and generalise things that have happened to us. This explains why I can't remember whether I've turned off the gas under the kettle or not. If you do a task regularly, your memories of that task merge together. Because of this, most of the fine details are lost amid an ocean of generalisations, meaning we find it hard to pick out the more mundane experiences of our past. A little trick I have subsequently learned is to make a different animal noise out loud when switching off the gas under my kettle. It feels silly at the time, but it makes the action of turning the gas off much more memorable when trying to recollect whether you've done it later in the day. The animal noise prevents the memory from being grouped within the sea of similar experiences. You wouldn't want to do this all the time. We use memories of our past experiences to help guide our decisions about the future. If we were able to recollect our past in any great detail, it could take us forever to sort through it all. Oblivion, said James, except in certain cases, is thus no malady of memory, but a condition of its health and its life. Having learned this, I wasn't surprised to hear that Jill struggled with her daily bombardment of memories. It had led to several bouts of depression. She often felt desperately sad, said McGough, constantly remembering the worst times in her life. Normally, people don't tend to dwell on the past, but Jill's constant recollections seem to link one event to another in an unstoppable manner. McGough knows of no other person who is both warden and prisoner of their memories. I ask Bob whether he's ever met Jill. No, he says, but from what I've heard, her memories seem to consume her life. She's written that she feels haunted by the never-ending stream of memories that appear in her mind. Thankfully, it's not the same for me, or for the other people with HSAM that I've met. Indeed, most of McGough's small tribe don't tend to think of their mind as cluttered. They actually seem to enjoy organising their memories. They appear to be able to pull out memories at appropriate times, flicking through the past either for enjoyment or out of necessity. But what about the painful memories, I asked Bob. Isn't it horrid to remember them so vividly? When you remember painful memories and they feel as if they happened yesterday, you can see why it would be awful if that's all you think about. And sometimes, when something bad has happened once, if you're in a similar situation, you start reliving that past memory and it makes you anxious that it will repeat itself. But I think one of the benefits of remembering that bad stuff so vividly is that you can learn from your mistakes more easily than other people can. In what way? Just that being able to remember all the details and the way you felt when you made a mistake makes you think, okay, wow, I won't do that again, in a similar situation. And anyway, most of the time, the bad days aren't really that bad, so I don't dwell on any of that stuff. I like being in the present. As we eat, we talk about school and Bob's early life. I remember a lot of stuff from when I was young, but not the dates. I remember a few things from when I was really young. My earliest memory is of my mother holding me in her arms. I was drinking milk, he says. My earliest memory is also of my mum. except she was hanging me upside down over a sink in our downstairs toilet, trying to clear my airways during a particular nasty bout of whooping cough. I can clearly recall seeing the sink bounce in and out of view just inches from my nose and the tight, cramped space of the room. I later asked my mum whether she remembered this event. She said that it could have been one of many times during the month I had the illness. She remembered several occasions having to pull thick phlegm out of my throat with her fingers. I was 2.5 years old. "What were you, like 2, 3? I asked Bob. I am assuming that that earliest memory refers to drinking milk as a toddler, but the smile on his face makes me pause. "I think I was drinking from the breast," he says. "You are kidding me." He laughs. "You know, I always joke about this, but I think it's true," he says. I remember she had this contented look on her face. I think that memory would have been around 9 months or something. I was definitely a baby. This intrigues me. A memory from 9 months old. Was that possible? Even for a man who never forgets? Our earliest memories are normally a blurry echo at best. Several theories have been proposed as to why we have this so-called infantile amnesia. Freud, of course, blamed it on adults suppressing sexual fantasies of early childhood that they were later too ashamed to remember, a theory that has since been discredited. The more likely explanation is that the neurons in the brain responsible for forming memories are growing, maturing, and being pruned rapidly during the first few years of life. As new neurons are produced, particularly in the hippocampus, the brain must clear out older memories to make room. When Paul Frankland, a scientist at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto, accelerated the production of new brain cells in the hippocampus of baby mice, he discovered that they forgot more. When he did the reverse, slowing the growth of neurons using a chemotherapy drug, the pups remembered more than usual. Another theory is that as young infants we lack self-perception and language skills, which are perhaps necessary to embed our memories into contexts that we are later able to look back on in our adult life. So does this mean that Bob's 9-month-old memory was fake? I asked Patricia Bauer, professor of psychology at Emory University in Georgia, and an expert in infantile amnesia. She said there is a wide variation in the age of her earliest memories, from late in the first year to as old as 9. So yes, she said, it was possible to have a memory from 9 months old, but that in a typical person we would suspect its accuracy. It would be tough to say that the memory is of a single event rather than a reconstruction based on lots of similar events in which the person took part, not to mention the huge number of images of infant feeding we view over a lifetime. So maybe Bob's memory was correct, or maybe it was a culmination of several similar moments that happened early in his life. Regardless, it raised another question. Can we ever trust our own memory? Mitt Romney once recalled a memory to a crowd of Tea Party supporters about his attendance at the Golden Jubilee, an event that celebrated the 50th anniversary of the American automobile and attracted 750,000 people. The Jubilee was famous for including one of the last public appearances by Henry Ford. The problem was, it took place on the 1st of June 1946, 9 months before Romney was born. Was he lying? The Republican Party leader said his memory was hazy and that he was 4 or 5 at the time. In fact, it was likely that he had heard the story from his dad and it had inserted itself within his own memory, forming what he later considered a true recollection of the event. It wasn't until the 1990s that researchers really started scientifically testing the idea of false memories, when the cognitive psychologist Elizabeth Loftus, now at the University of Washington, wrote about an experiment her team had performed on a boy called Chris. The 14-year-old Chris described an experience of visiting a local shopping mall in Washington when he was 5. He remembered the visit in incredible detail because he got lost after walking off to visit a toy store. Unable to find his family, he thought, "Uh-oh, I'm in trouble now." He remembered thinking he was never going to see them again. Eventually, an old man with a bald head and flannel shirt helped reunite them all. The strange thing is, most of this story never actually happened. It was made up by Jim, Chris's elder brother, in collaboration with Loftus. Jim had fed Chris some of the basic facts of the story, the old man, the mall, but Chris had filled in the rest of the details. Chris's story showed that it is possible to plant completely false memories into a person's mind. Since then, Loftus and others have repeated this experiment, implanting all sorts of fake memories, from choking and near drowning to demonic possession. Even the most educated minds can be manipulated. When Loftus was just 14 years old, her mother drowned in a swimming pool. On her 44th birthday, Loftus attended a family gathering at which an uncle informed her that she had been the one to discover her mother's dead body. Although she had previously remembered little about her mother's death, suddenly memories of the incident came flooding back. A few days later, Loftus's brother called her and told her that their uncle had made a mistake. It had actually been an aunt that had found their mother. The memories that had appeared so clear and vivid for the past few days were entirely false. Loftus's own experiment had been inadvertently performed on herself. Fake memories can have some serious consequences. On the 15th of November 1989, 15-year-old Angela Correa went missing from school. A few days later, her body was found, raped and strangled to death. Suspicious of 17-year-old Jeffrey Deskovich, a student who had been absent from school during the time Correa went missing, police brought him in for questioning. After being interrogated for 6 hours, he finally confessed to the murder. Although DNA testing did not match Deskovich, he was convicted on the basis of his confession and faced life in jail. 16 years later, new DNA evidence matched the crime to Stephen Cunningham, a man who was serving time for another murder and who subsequently confessed. Deskovich was pardoned and released. You may find it inconceivable that a false confession could be extracted, but it happens on a surprisingly regular basis. A campaign group in the US called the Innocence Project proposed that false confessions play a role in almost a quarter of US convictions. Perhaps you think you're impervious to this kind of manipulation, but you'd be surprised just how easily you could succumb. Recently, Loftus showed that a lack of sleep can cause people to make false confessions after getting students to admit to pressing the wrong button on a computer task, wiping out a week's worth of data. In fact, they hadn't done any such thing. But half of the students who hadn't slept the night before the task believed they had a memory of the event and signed a confession, compared with less than a fifth of those who'd had a good night's sleep. Tiredness, low IQ, leading questions, all of these things can help convince us to forge a memory of something that never happened. These examples reveal something quite extraordinary, that our memories, once formed, are not fixed. Each time we retrieve a memory, we strengthen the neural pathways that have created it, and in doing so reinforce and consolidate that memory so that it becomes lodged more permanently in our minds. But for a short time during this retrieval process, our memory becomes malleable. We are able to reshape it and sometimes contaminate it. I wondered, was this the secret behind Bob's incredible memory? Was there something special about the way he retrieved memories that allowed him to strengthen and consolidate them more accurately and more permanently than the rest of us? It was Billy Mayer, Bob was saying. They thought he was involved with a girl called Katrina Young. His wife had left him at the time and they became friends, and that's where the scandal came from. But there's never been any proof that it was true. People looked into it, but no one proved they were seeing each other. He wasn't seeing her, but it was pretty bad for the town. I must look puzzled because he stops mid-sentence. I'm sorry, sometimes I have to think about what I'm saying, he laughs. It turns out that Bob is talking about Holland College, a whole community based around a school basketball team called the Golden Knights, a powerhouse in collegiate sports, who have played in several championships and boast numerous high-profile sportsmen, such as Otis Pookie and Isaac Mosley. Bob is the Knights' biggest fan, because the team, in fact the whole community, exists only in his imagination. It started when he was young. Bob decided to create his own imaginary basketball team. Each of the players lived in a place called Tigertown, and he would play whole basketball games in his mind. The team would compete in championships, and they would win and lose. He thought he would stop, but as he aged, so too did the team. The players worked their way through college, then went off and married and had kids. Nowadays, most have full-time jobs. Some have died in tragic accidents, others from old age. It's like a 50-year-long book in my brain, says Bob. If this sounds obsessive to you, it's because it is. Bob has many obsessions. He's a self-confessed germaphobe too. If I drop my keys on the ground, I'll scrub them under hot water, he admits. These obsessions were the vital clue that McGough had been searching for. It soon became apparent that other people with highly superior autobiographical memory, or H-Sammers, as they like to call themselves, had some kind of obsessive-compulsive tendencies. For Jill, it was her diaries. Sometimes her writing was so small and packed so tightly onto the page that she couldn't read it back. For others, it was remembering where and when they had first worn a pair of shoes, or cleaning, or watching certain television programs over and over again. Most of them also appeared to enjoy organizing and replaying their memories in some way or another. For instance, when Bob is stuck in traffic, he tries to recall his favorite memories of that particular date, say, every 1st of March since he was 5. Or he might try to remember every day that happened in June 1969. This obsessiveness was a really intriguing part of the puzzle, says McGough. To find out more, he got some of his growing tribe of H-Summers, who are now more than 50 strong, to take part in various tests that stretched other aspects of their mind, such as verbal fluency and ability to memorise faces and names. He wanted to see if they excelled at anything else. Unfortunately, the results were inconclusive. Just like Jill, the H-Summers weren't much better than others their age at any of the tests. They certainly didn't excel in any. So McGough tried another tack. He asked his participants to recall events that happened on each day of the preceding week, as well as a week that occurred 1 month, 1 year, and 10 years earlier. A month later, McGough surprised his participants by asking them to recall the same dates, allowing his team to check the consistency of their memories. As you might expect, those with H-SAM had far superior memory of days further in the past. What was surprising, though, was that both groups could remember the same quality and quantity of information from the preceding week. That was enough to convince McGough that Bob and the others are no better than you or me at acquiring memories. They are not superior learners. They are simply better at retaining them. He wanted more clues to the puzzle, so next he scanned their brains. There he found some subtle differences in the structure of 9 regions, including an enlarged caudate nucleus and putamen. This was particularly intriguing because both of these areas have also been implicated in obsessive-compulsive disorder. Was it a coincidence? The universe is rarely so lazy, said Sherlock Holmes. McGough, too, reckoned there had to be more to it. It seems, he says, that the initial process of translating an event into synaptic activity, what's called encoding a memory, in H-SAMers is no different to how it works for the rest of us. So too is the mechanism they use to retrieve a memory. The difference between people with H-SAM and the rest of us seems to be happening between the encoding and retrieval process, a point we call consolidation. Perhaps, says McGough, their extraordinary powers of memory are rooted in an unconscious rehearsal of their past. Not that Jill and Bob and the others actively try to memorise their past in order to remember it. That would take some considerable dedication. Instead, he believes that they accidentally strengthen their memories by habitually recalling and reflecting upon them. It could be a unique form of OCD, he says. At the time of writing, McGough is 85, and after more than 50 years of memory research, is near to retirement. He is a man who is clearly passionate about finding out what gives a handful of people such an incredible memory. I was interested to know why he had dedicated so much of his time to such a niche talent. These are not small effects, he says. Their brain must be working in a different way to others. He wonders whether it was an ability that all humans had early on and had lost because there was no pressure to retain these memories. Or it was perhaps an abnormal genetic condition that sprang up from nowhere. Whatever it is quite remarkable, he says. How the hell does it happen? That's the question. And that has always been my quest, to understand this marvellous machinery that we call the brain. Something Bob said as we finished our meal stuck with me. You know, one of the best things about having a perfect memory, he said, is the ability to remember those I have lost. I make sure I think a lot about people I love when they're alive, so that I can go back to any time in their life that I was with them and remember it like it was yesterday. Then, if they're no longer with me, it's like I can still spend time with them. The people I've lost don't feel like they're truly gone, because my memories of them are so clear. I can go back to my younger brother's life and not have to mourn him like others do, because I can remember our times together so well. I think about people a lot and appreciate my time with them, because once they're gone, they won't be here, but my memories always will be. I've thought about that a lot since we met. When my mum was diagnosed with incurable breast cancer, it motivated me to spend the last year of her life making a special effort to concentrate on the time we were spending together. Those memories, I hope, are there for good. I know my memory will never be as perfect as Bob's or Jill's, But others, like Mullen and Kotanowski, have shown me that even my ordinary brain is capable of remembering so much more than I ever realised, just by creating a special palace around my memories that can never be erased. Chapter 2. Sharon. Being Permanently Lost. 1952. Out on the front lawn, Sharon was blindfolded while her friends ran around her, laughing, trying not to be caught in a game of blind man's buff. Sharon grabbed hold of someone's sleeve and whipped off the scarf that covered her eyes. "You're it," she shouted. Then she blinked and looked around her. Suddenly, panic started to rise. The house, the street, it all looked different. She had no idea where she was. Sharon ran into the back garden and discovered her mother sitting in a lawn chair. "What are you doing here?" Sharon asked. "Whose backyard is this? Where am I?" Her mother looked at her, puzzled. "What's wrong with you?" she asked her daughter. "This is our house." Sharon was totally disorientated. She told her mother that everything around her looked different. Her mother looked irritated. She wanted to know why Sharon thought this wasn't her home. Sharon didn't understand. Why wasn't her mother helping her? "I don't know where this place is. It all looks wrong," she said. "I'm so confused." Her mum looked her in the eye and pointed a finger at her face. "Don't ever tell anybody about this," she said, "because they'll say you're a witch and burn you." Present day. "I can remember that moment as if it were yesterday," Sharon says over the phone. "I was 5 years old." Sharon had woken up the following morning knowing that something weird had happened again. She says it was as though her walls had moved in her sleep. She was in her bedroom, but things didn't look like they were in the right place. Her door was on the wrong side of her for a start. "I knew it had to be my bedroom," she says, "and bits of the room were familiar, but it was all wrong at the same time. Nothing was where I thought it should be." Sharon didn't know it at the time, but her brain was having trouble producing an accurate mental map of her surroundings. Sharon's disorientation began to occur more and more frequently until it became a constant presence throughout her day. It made finding her way around her neighbourhood and her school completely impossible. In spite of this, she never mentioned her problem to anyone. Instead, she used a natural sense of humour and sharp intelligence to complete her education, make friends, and even get married without anyone ever knowing she was almost permanently lost. "I hid it for 25 years," she says. 25 years? "Yeah, well, you know, the witch thing." Sharon's condition was one of the most peculiar I had ever come across. The loss of an ability that I had never given a second's thought to. The ability to orient. I had first heard about the condition after it was described in a medical journal called Neuropsychologia. One of the authors of the paper had been kind enough to put me in touch with Sharon, whose case was among the most severe he had ever discovered. Eager to find out more about this mysterious disorder, and to include Sharon in my journey, I emailed her. "Would she mind if I came over to Denver to meet her in person?" "That would be wonderful," she replied. I was keen to see her in her own home. Even there, she said, she can get lost walking between her bathroom and her kitchen. Just hours after saying farewell to Bob, I grab some sleep in a musty motel that smells of damp clothes and cheese and wake at the crack of dawn to get back to the airport. Bleary-eyed, I arrive in Denver. My phone beeps as I sit in the car park, familiarising myself with the left-hand drive of my rental car. It's a text from Sharon. "I hope you can find your way here without a problem. Call me if you get lost. Maybe I'll be able to guide you. Ha! What am I thinking?" I smile and switch on the sat-nav. The screen flashes and then goes dead. Eventually, I manage to get the map to appear, although the image is dark and fuzzy. The irony isn't lost on me, despite my jet lag. Several wrong turns later, I pull into a quiet neighbourhood full of neat little condos. I work my way around the maze of streets and spot Sharon standing on her veranda, waving down at me. I announce my arrival to her neighbours by starting the car alarm while attempting to turn off the engine and change out of my driving shoes. I am wearing only one sandal when Sharon opens the car door. It wasn't exactly the first impression I had intended to make. Nevertheless, she greets me with a warm hug and a huge smile on her face. "It's so great to meet you finally. Aren't you just adorable?" Sharon has flaming copper hair swept into a stylish crop that is set off by a bright pink blouse. The colours complement her deep red lipstick. Her sunglasses instantly remind me of one of those slightly eccentric grandmas you see in Hollywood movies. I surreptitiously slip on my second sandal and follow her to her front door, where we are met by a giant metal lobster with the word "Welcome" written across his rusty belly. Sharon shows me into her house, which is open plan, peaceful, and as neat as a pin. She offers me a drink and we wander into the kitchen, where I stop to stare at her fridge. There's the normal assortment of memorabilia stuck on the door. Pictures of friends, magnets, telephone numbers, notes from grandchildren, a picture of Wonder Woman. But it's a large piece of paper right in the centre that catches my eye. It is a photo of a handsome young Italian, with thick eyebrows and three-day-old stubble, looking into the distance. It is held up with a magnet that says, "A true friend knows everything about you and likes you anyway." A smaller photo of Sharon and the same man, sitting at a dinner table together, arms around each other's shoulders and smiling at the camera, is pinned above it. "Who's that?" I ask. "That's Giuseppe. Isn't he cute? He's such a gentle and compassionate man. He changed my life." As a young postdoc, Giuseppe Iaria was fascinated by navigation. His interest had begun as an undergraduate student, where he worked on a project investigating why people with damage to one side of their brain sometimes have problems navigating. Later, while working at the University of British Columbia, he decided to investigate why some healthy people have a better sense of direction than others. One day, completely out of the blue, a middle-aged woman, whom I will call Claire, showed up at his lab complaining of a peculiar problem. She was constantly lost. Iaria suspected that Claire's disorientation was the result of some other condition. He began ruling out possible options one by one. He knew, for instance, that inner ear infections can damage a delicate tissue called the labyrinth, causing the sensation that your world is moving around you. Perhaps it was this, he thought, that was causing Claire to feel disorientated. Brain tumours, lesions and dementia can damage the hippocampus, which, as we know, is involved in many types of memory. Could one of these things be preventing Claire from being able to remember her way around? Or maybe it was epilepsy that was stopping her from being able to memorise directions. Sudden bursts of uncontrolled electrical activity in the brain can do that. It took Iaria and his mentor, Jason Barton, 2 years to cross off all the potential problems. But, as far as their tests showed, Claire was in perfect health. Claire told Iaria that she hadn't lost the ability to orientate herself. She'd just never learned it in the first place. She recalled that from the age of 6, she would panic at the supermarket each time her mother disappeared from view. During school, she would have to travel with her sisters or parents and never left home by herself because she got lost each time she tried. As an adult, Claire had figured out how to get to work by taking a particular bus and memorising the stop and a prominent landmark near her office. But her work was moving to an unfamiliar area, and she had decided it was time to get some professional help. Iaria was intrigued. He routinely encountered disorientation as a symptom of other conditions, but never as a developmental disorder, one that occurs as you grow up. Determined to get to the bottom of the problem, he took Claire out for a short walk around the local area. He then handed her detailed directions for how to repeat the route by herself. Claire followed the directions without any mistakes. However, when Iaria asked her to draw a map of the route she had just walked, or of the town in which she lived, she found it impossible. She said she did not have, in my mind, a map to report. Iaria called her patient one and named the condition developmental topographical disorientation disorder, the inability to generate, and therefore use, a mental map of your surroundings, despite an absence of any brain damage. Iaria figured that there must be others out there with the same condition and created a website to encourage people to test their navigational skills. He also went on a radio chat show to talk about the disorder. In the middle of the broadcast, he received a phone call live on air. "It was like we'd staged it," he told me. "A guy called in and said, 'I'm always lost. I've always been this way. I've told people about it and they just don't get it. They think I'm distracted and I give up. I don't tell people about it anymore. They just don't believe me that I can be that bad at directions.'" Over time, Iaria found others. One person told him, "No matter how long I live in the same building, I can never picture in my mind where the washroom is." Sharon was case number four. Unfortunately, by this time, she was 61 years old. I settle on the sofa with a glass of water. Sharon sits opposite. Take me back to the beginning. Were you permanently lost from the age of five? No, she says. Some of the time my world looked perfectly normal and I could navigate perfectly well. But then all of a sudden my world would flip and I'd become completely disorientated. And you never told anyone? No, instead I was this class clown. I thought if I could stand up and make the class laugh, they wouldn't know my secret. So I became this comedienne. So no one ever noticed that most of the time you were completely lost? No, I would just follow my friends when we walked to school, and if it happened during class, I'd spend the rest of the lesson trying to memorise the way the room looked so that I'd know where everything was the next time it happened. One day, when Sharon was still a young girl, she came across a solution. She was at a friend's party and next in line to play Pin the Tail on the Donkey. You know the one, she says, where you're blindfolded and you spin around and then try to stick the tail in the right place. After I spun around, I just knew something was horribly wrong. I felt like I was walking in completely the wrong direction. I pinned the tail on the donkey and everyone laughed like they do, and I took the blindfold off. I thought, I know I'm at my friend's house, but this doesn't look like my friend's house. This momentary crisis turned out to be the saving grace that would help her navigate the rest of her life. For when it was her turn to be blindfolded and spun around for a second time, Sharon's world flipped back to normal. That's when I learned that spinning could cause the disorientation to happen, but that it also fixed it. These days, I usually try to find the nearest bathroom, Sharon says. I go into a cubicle, close my eyes, and spin around. I can't quite describe the sensation. It's not a sound, just a sense that everything feels back to normal. When I open my eyes, my world is recognisable again. She chuckles and points to the picture pinned to her fridge. I call it my Wonder Woman impression. Why do you do it in the bathroom? Well, what would you think if you saw an old woman standing by her car, spinning around in circles with her eyes closed? She has a point. I always did it in secret because I was humiliated by it all. For most of us, navigating feels easy and automatic. You arrive in a new city and your brain starts trying to make sense of the place. On your first day, you find your home, your base for the trip, and over time you start recognising certain landmarks. You become familiar with your surroundings. Many of Iaria's patients feel like they live in a constant first day. No matter how much time they spend somewhere, their surroundings never become familiar. Like Claire, many have learned to navigate the most important routes in their life by remembering a specific sequence of turns. To get from their desk to the bathroom, for instance, they know they need to turn left at the printer, right at the potted plant, and go through the double doors. But there's a reason why this isn't how you or I navigate. To remember all your journeys this way would place a huge strain on your memory. Instead, we use a dynamic tool, what scientists call a cognitive map, a kind of internal representation of our surroundings that becomes familiar so that we don't have to remember a specific sequence of directions, but can merely visualise where things are in relation to one another and ourselves. Try it for yourself now. If I asked you to think about the route you'd need to take to get to the bathroom, could you do it? You probably don't even have to try. We tend to take for granted the ability to picture a route in our mind's eye, but it is a remarkable skill. In fact, one of the most sophisticated behaviours that our brain can perform, and one that has puzzled scientists for decades. Part of the problem is that normal navigation enlists several areas of the brain, all of which are having an incredibly complex conversation with one another. When she's not scanning world memory champions, Eleanor Maguire spends a great deal of her time trying to work out exactly what parts of the brain are doing the talking. Her motivations aren't completely selfless. Although she is one of the UK's top navigation researchers, she is also hopeless with directions. It was absolutely the reason I got into this area of research, she said, when I dropped by her lab one day. I'm so bad at directions, it's really debilitating. We were sitting in her office in Bloomsbury, central London. Maguire tells me that when she goes out the front door, she will deliberately turn in the opposite direction to where she thinks she needs to go. That way, she said, I'm correct about 90% of the time. One afternoon, not long ago, I hurried past Maguire's lab on my way to get my hair cut. I was late, so I rushed to the main road and stuck out my hand. I was rewarded by the appearance of Jeff, a black cab driver who had been ferrying people around the streets of London for more than 20 years. I climbed into the back seat and reached for my seatbelt. "Where to, love?" he asked. "South Moulton Street," I replied. Without a second's thought, Jeff spun the cab around, slipped down a side street and headed directly to the salon. He never once consulted a map. That's because he had mastered the knowledge, a famous test that all London cabbies must pass, which involves learning all 25,000 roads within a 6-mile radius of Charing Cross Station. Maguire wondered whether cab drivers like Jeff, who have an incredible sense of direction, might reveal what makes other people so good at navigating. By scanning their brains, she discovered that the back part, posterior, of the hippocampus in taxi drivers is larger compared with non-taxi drivers. But was that a result of being a taxi driver, or were people with bigger hippocampi just more likely to become taxi drivers? To find out, Maguire scanned the brains of 79 trainee taxi drivers several times over 4 years as they began to learn the knowledge. Those who passed the test had a bigger posterior hippocampus than when they started, whereas there were no changes seen in trainee taxi drivers who failed their exams or in 31 people whose age, education and intelligence were similar to the taxi drivers, but who had never attempted to learn the knowledge. Clearly, the hippocampi were growing alongside navigational abilities, which raises the question, how do they help us get from A to B? In the 1960s, the British neuroscientist John O'Keefe, also at University College London, began dabbling with the idea that the secret to normal navigation lay in the hippocampus. To test this theory, O'Keefe studied the brains of rats as they walked around an open space. He wanted to know which neurons were active as the rodents explored their environment. He did this by placing a set of thin electrodes into their hippocampus, which could record the little spike of electricity that occurs when an individual neuron is communicating with its neighbours. Using this technique, O'Keefe discovered a type of cell that fired only when the animal was in a specific location. Each time the rat passed through this location, pop, that cell would fire. A nearby cell seemed only to care about a different location. Pop! It would fire whenever the rat walked through that location. The next cell would only respond to another location, and so on. Pop, pop, pop! The combination of activity of many of these cells could tell you exactly where that rat was to within 5 centimetres squared. O'Keefe named them place cells and showed how together they told the rest of the brain, "This is where I am in my environment right now." Over the next few decades, it was discovered that place cells don't do this job alone. They receive input from 3 other kinds of cells in a nearby region called the entorhinal cortex. One type of cell is called a grid cell and was discovered by May Britt Moser and Edvard Moser, former husband and wife team, both born on remote islands on the outer west coast of Norway. The Mosers realised that our ability to navigate partly relies on us being able to think about how we are moving and where we have come from. Consider the way you head to the ticket machine in a car park and then reverse the movements of your body to return to your car. The Mosers discovered that grid cells were the neurons responsible for integrating this information into our cognitive map. To understand how grid cells work, imagine running around a carpet that is covered in a grid of interlocking hexagons, a bit like a beehive. One grid cell will fire whenever you reach the corners of any hexagon in that grid. Shift the grid along ever so slightly to another section of the carpet, and another grid cell will be responsible for firing every time you reach the corners of that grid's hexagons, and so on. These cells establish a generic map of space, giving you constantly updated information about your position and the relative distance between certain landmarks. The entorhinal cortex is also home to border cells. These cells give you information about where you are in relation to certain walls and boundaries. One might only fire, say, when there's a wall that is close by to the south. Another might fire when you're midway between 2 walls, or when you're near the edge of a cliff. To complete the picture, border cells also share their real estate with head direction cells, which, as the name implies, fire only when an animal's face is turned in a specific direction. The most widely accepted theory of how we find our way around the world is that our brain stores patterns of how place cells fire in a specific location so that they can act as a guide for when we return to that location. Imagine looking for your car after a long day's shopping, for instance. Your place cells crackle away, influenced by the direction of your head, the movement of your body, and the landscape around you. They guide you around until the current pattern of activity matches that of the stored pattern, and voila, you've found your car. That's not the end of the story, however. Despite all this activity, our internal compass is incomplete. We're still missing a piece of the navigational puzzle. One so important that its loss can mean the difference between life and death. When you find my body, please call my husband George and my daughter Kerry. It will be the greatest kindness for them to know that I am dead and where you found me, no matter how many years from now. When 66-year-old Geraldine Largay stepped a short way off the Appalachian Trail to relieve herself, she never expected that she wouldn't be able to find her way back. Known to her friends as Jerry, she was a retired Air Force nurse who had hiked other long trails near her hometown in Tennessee. She had taken a course on how to traverse the entire Appalachian Trail, which runs over 2,200 miles and crosses 14 states, and had completed more than 1,000 miles of the six-month journey. On the 22nd of July 2013, Jerry tried to text her husband, who was waiting at a nearby checkpoint, ready to deliver her fresh supplies for the next leg of the trek. "In some trouble," it said. "Got off trail to go to bathroom. Now lost. Can you call AMC to see if a trail maintainer can help me? Somewhere north of Woods Road. XOX. Lack of signal meant the text never sent, so Jerry camped down for the night. The following day, an official search began. For weeks, they scoured the thick woodland to find her. In October 2015, a forester working for the US Navy discovered a human skull with a sleeping bag around it. According to a report in the New York Times, a flattened tent lay a short distance away, along with a green rucksack containing Jerry's possessions, neatly packed into Ziploc bags. Nearby was a moss-covered notebook that said, "George, please read, XOXO." In the notebook, Jerry explained that she had walked for 2 days after being unable to find her way back to the path. As she had been taught in her training, she set up camp in the hope that someone would find her. The last entry was dated 18th of August, 2013. While it is impossible to say what Jerry could have done to avoid this tragic fate, her disorientation was no doubt aggravated by the fact that she left the path at one of its most rugged sections. She wouldn't have had to walk far before she was surrounded by thick underbrush and identical fir trees packed so tightly it would have quickly become impossible to make out the trail. There was nothing that distinguished one direction from the other. In short, there were no landmarks. You might not think much of being able to remember that there's a postbox at the end of your street or a bus stop outside your office, but in fact the ability to recognise and incorporate these permanent landmarks into your internal map of the world is incredibly important. We constantly fill our mental maps with things that are meaningful to us. Think about directing someone from the nearest station to your home. What features of the route would you use to keep them on track? I'd use my local Art Deco pub, a museum containing an overstuffed walrus, and a distinctive triangular hill under which victims of the plague are buried. Our ability to recognise familiar landmarks is so important that there's a part of the brain that is dedicated to the task. It's called the retrosplenial cortex, and when it's damaged, it leads to severe problems in navigating. When working correctly, our spatial memory is outstanding. But with the use of technology, GPS, sat-nav, mobile maps in the palm of our hand, could we all lose our ability to navigate? Calculators, after all, have caused many people to suffer a drop in their mental arithmetic skills. In a commentary in the journal Nature, Roger McKinley, former president of the Royal Institute of Navigation, says that this might indeed be the case. If we do not cherish them, our natural navigation abilities will deteriorate as we rely ever more on smart devices, he said. Our natural navigational skills can indeed be blocked by technology. Studies have shown that people who follow GPS systems to get from one place to another find it more difficult to work out where they have been than people who use traditional paper maps. Like many of our brain's talents, it's a case of use it or lose it. In 2009, Maguire and her colleagues showed that London taxi drivers who had recently retired performed worse on navigation tests than drivers the same age who were still guiding passengers around the capital. Whether our technological crutches will eventually erode our natural navigational skills is unclear. A much more pertinent problem comes from not noticing that your tech is taking you somewhere you don't want to go. In 2013, an elderly Belgian woman set out on the 38-mile journey to her home in Brussels, but after mistakenly entering the wrong address in her GPS, arrived in Zagreb 901 miles and 2 days later. Some stories are more tragic. In 2015, on her way to the beach, a businesswoman was shot dead in Brazil after a navigational app made her take a road through a gang-controlled favela. Even the most technologically advanced navigational systems may know where they are, but they don't always know the best way to go. So are we becoming dangerously de-skilled? Putting your faith in your sat-nav rarely leads to such awful situations, and is unlikely to diminish your natural abilities completely. But it's important to remember that you carry around with you an internal map that is, for now, more powerful than the smartest GPS. Sharon and I set off for lunch at a nearby restaurant. I offer to drive, but Sharon insists she knows the way and that it won't be a problem. These were lines delivered with confidence. But should a woman who has difficulty finding her own kitchen really get behind the wheel? I've been keeping a watchful eye on Sharon as she showed me around her house. I don't know what I was expecting, perhaps for her to look confused suddenly and then bump into a wall or something. But nothing out of the ordinary had happened, so I happily jump into the passenger seat. From her condo, we drive around a couple of roundabouts, pass through a set of traffic lights and indicate left then right without a hitch. We turn safely onto a small highway that runs through the town, the snow-topped foothills of the Rocky Mountains dominating the landscape to the west. Sharon points to the mountains and tells me that sometimes she'll be driving into town when she suddenly realises that the mountains are to the north, and she'll know that her world has flipped. Before I am able to process this statement, she points to our restaurant. Then we fly past the entrance. I can't go in that way because it's a big curved road, she says, as if that's a perfectly obvious explanation for our detour. As we park, I glance up at the mountains, so solid and unmoving. How could they suddenly face north? We sit down in South Sobrava and order two iced teas. I ask Sharon to go back to basics. Can you explain exactly what you see when your world flips? She pauses for a moment and then tells me to think about a busy shopping street in London. I choose Oxford Circus with its heaving crowds and constant flow of human traffic. Imagine you've had a busy day shopping, she says. You come out of the last shop and head left towards the station. I picture the scene. All of a sudden, though, you realise the station is actually on your right, because you were in a shop on the opposite side of the street to where you thought you were. In that split second, you feel momentarily disorientated, because the station that you thought should be east is now west. Your world hasn't literally flipped, but your perception of it has. When that happens, most people's brains are surprisingly forgiving. As soon as it gets confused, the brain spins everything around and reorientates itself, and you, within milliseconds. But that split second in which your mental map doesn't match where things actually are is how Sharon says she feels when her world is flipped. So when she says the mountains are suddenly to the north, it's because her mental map has shifted them to the north, even though they haven't physically moved an inch. I just can't flip my world back around like you can, she says, unless I do my Wonder Woman impression. I ask why we had to take a detour into the restaurant. Sharon explains that curved roads make her world flip. It has made finding work difficult. In her mid-twenties, she struggled to find a job. Every time she had an interview, she would have to work out in advance where the building was and whether it sat on a curved road. If there were a lot of winding passengers in the building itself, she would have to turn down the job altogether. I want to know more about what Sharon's alternate world looked like. Was it not possible for her to recognise enough of her environment to work out which way to turn? It's hard to explain, she says. Think about standing in front of a bathroom cabinet with a mirrored door. Open that door and look at the rest of the room through it, and you'll know it's your bathroom, but everything's kind of in the wrong place. Plus you're stressed because everything looks different. It makes it hard. When Sharon has to get up in the middle of the night to go to the toilet, or if she's in a rush in the morning and doesn't have time to do her Wonder Woman impression, she says she feels like she is in a whole other condo. When she had young kids, she would have to follow their cries to find their room if they woke her suddenly in the night. When it happens at home, I know I'm in my kitchen, but but I can't tell you what's contained in any of the cabinets or drawers because I don't have any attachment to them. I have to say to myself, okay, pretend you're in your correct kitchen, and I know when I need a spoon, I go to the drawer to the right of the fridge. So I look at the fridge in this other kitchen, and I say to myself, okay, that's where the spoons are. Throughout school, Sharon continued to hide her problem from her friends and family. The seeds of condemnation planted by her mother at such a young age had clearly taken hold. I feel a wave of sympathy. Sharon is so likeable, so friendly, funny, and intelligent. I'm amazed that she kept this to herself for so long. Sharon was almost 30 before her secret came out in the open. Her brother had phoned her asking to be taken to the hospital. He suffered from Crohn's disease and was feeling unwell. Sharon rushed out of the house in a panic, got into the car and set off on the short journey to his house. But somewhere along the way, her world flipped and she got completely lost. She pulled into a gas station to use the phone. She called her brother. "I can't find your house," she said, and described the gas station. Her brother was confused. He said, "You're 2 blocks away from me. How do you not know where you are?" After the two of them had returned from the hospital, her brother asked her what was going on. "It was so emotional for me, I could hardly say the words." It was the first time Sharon had talked about her condition since she was 5. "After I told him what my mother had said, he was so mad, but he understood why I hadn't said anything. Our parents weren't well. We didn't have a normal childhood." Sharon's brother told his doctor about her condition, and the doctor set up a meeting with a neurologist. With appointments to go to, Sharon was forced to tell her now ex-husband everything. Up until that moment, she had managed to hide it from him very successfully. "I did very little driving, and the places I drove to were only very close to my house," she explains. "I had already routed them out on straight streets so I wouldn't get lost." My thoughts about her bumping into things weren't completely off the mark. She told me that she had been terrified of not being able to take care of her children in an emergency. When she jumped out of bed to get to her children in the dark, she would almost always run into a wall. Her husband just thought she was clumsy. "I allowed him to think that, rather than trying to explain. I just felt so stupid." When Sharon finally admitted the truth after 8 years of marriage, the only thing she remembers him saying was, "Is that why you're always asking me which direction we're driving?" He just didn't seem interested. Sharon's neurologist told her that since she'd had the problem for so many years, it sounded like she might have a benign tumour or epilepsy. "In either case," he said, "we'll put you in hospital, do lots of tests and try to fix it." True to his word, he organised a barrage of tests, looking for signs of strange brain activity that would suggest epilepsy, or an anatomical lesion that might explain the loss of direction. "I just thought, please God, let there be something that they can fix," says Sharon. But there was no epilepsy, no lesions. Sharon's brain looked completely healthy. "They said I needed to see a psychiatrist. They thought I was crazy." The diagnosis caused her to suffer a bout of severe depression. "I wanted to die," she said. "I just had my hopes raised, thinking that the doctors would find something that could be fixed." Sharon saw a psychologist for more than a year, and although he helped her work through her depression, he was unable to fix her disorientation. He told her to keep checking in with a neurologist every few years to see if the research community had discovered anything new. He said, "I truly believe that this is something happening in your brain that we just haven't learned about." It wasn't until Sharon turned 40 that she felt strong enough to follow his advice. She made an appointment to see a doctor at the hospital she was working in as an administrative assistant. But as soon as she sat down, she felt uncomfortable. "This doctor gets out her little pad and paper and asks me what was going on," says Sharon. "I tried to tell her as simply as I could, that my world lifts up, turns around and sets back down and I'm totally lost. She looked at me like I'm telling her a made-up story. She asked me how I correct it, and I told her I spin around and it fixes it. She said, 'Let me see you do it.'" Sharon was taken by surprise. She had never spun around in front of anyone before. She winces at the memory. "I swallowed my pride, stood up and closed my eyes. It was so embarrassing. I spun around in circles until I knew the world had flipped." The doctor asked Sharon what she saw. "I said, 'Well, I'm in a different room now. I know logically I'm not, but this doesn't look like the same room as when I came in.'" Sharon spun around again and sat back down. The doctor put down her pen and pad and said, "Has anyone ever suggested the possibility that you have a multiple personality disorder?" Sharon was mortified. I'd shared my story and felt like I was being told I was crazy again. I just couldn't go through that again. I got my purse and left. It was another decade before Sharon made any further attempt to understand what was wrong with her brain. A friend had read some books by the neurologist Oliver Sacks and recommended that Sharon write to him about her symptoms. He replied a few weeks later,